Listener Production.
Hello, I'm Sasha Barbagat. Thanks for joining me this morning on The Briefing. Over the past 2 weeks, Alice Springs has had a curfew in place. From 6pm to 6am, people under the age of 18 have not been allowed in the town centre. The rule was brought in on March 27 after a state of emergency was declared following an increase in youth violence. That curfew was due to end this morning, but that all changed after an announcement by the Northern Territory Chief Minister Eva Lawler yesterday afternoon.
I think it's important to tell the community in Alice Springs that the curfew will be extended. The youth curfew will run until 6am on Tuesday, the first day back at school. The youth curfew will cover the entire school holidays.
Now, this extension came after a meeting on Monday afternoon between the Northern Territory Chief Minister, the Territory Emergency Council, and other local stakeholders to discuss how to successfully transition out of the curfew and how to find long-term strategies. So how are locals feeling about it all, and what do they want to see happen? Later in the episode, our producer Simon Beaton will bring you a conversation with an Indigenous social youth caseworker from Alice Springs. But first, let's get into the headlines with Antoinette Latouf. It is Wednesday, the 10th of April.
Thanks, Sasha. G'day, everyone. So despite more than 6 months of bloodshed in Gaza, Australia's foreign minister still believes, and I quote, "the only hope for peace is a two-state solution," and that the Australian government is considering recognising Palestinian statehood. So Penny Wong made the comments last night in a speech at the ANU, saying international recognition would help drive a two-state solution for Israel and Palestine.
"The simple truth is that a secure and prosperous future for both Israelis and Palestinians will only come with a two-state solution. Recognition of each other's right to exist."
Australia doesn't recognise Palestine as a state, but late last year it officially resumed use of the term occupied Palestinian territories, and that was a reversal of the coalition stance and acknowledging that Israel occupies settlements in Gaza and the West Bank illegally.
Wong also warned Benjamin Netanyahu against a ground offensive in Gaza's southernmost city of Rafah in this speech, and that is where over a million people are currently sheltering after being forced out of the north of the strip. And this all comes, of course, as the federal government continues to press Israel for transparency over the death of 7 aid workers in Gaza, including Australian Zomi Frankham, including allowing Special Advisor Air Chief Marshal Mark Binskin to review an Israeli probe into the incident. An Israel Defence Forces spokesperson has criticised the appointment, saying they were already rightly taking responsibility, quote-unquote, for the tragedy.
And Sasha, I think it's an interesting use of the word transparency, because the Australian government won't be transparent about what its arms deals and weapons deals it has with Israel. And I would argue that Palestinians at the moment, I'm hazarding a guess here, are probably more interested in the Australian government demanding a ceasefire and stop giving tools for killing to the IDF. There has been an FOI by the Greens. It's a 3-month process, and that FOI has been blocked. The FOI sought to find out exactly what Australia and Israel's defence cooperation is. The government has said it will not release it because it could harm Australia's international standing and reputation. So I don't know. I reckon talk of a two-state solution at this stage, it's just not pressing if there is no more state of Palestine because it is flattened.
Australia's domestic security agency is warning of a recent uptick in right-wing extremism here, with a focus on recruiting and radicalising. Also, that violent hate groups are still inspired by the Christchurch mosque massacre. ASIO has made a submission to a Senate inquiry revealing that a quarter of its counter-terror workload is currently related to ideologically motivated violent extremists, and that is different from religiously motivated extremism.
Yeah, so these groups are engaging in discussions about triggering a race war, that's according to ASIO, but are right now focused on gaining more people to their cause rather than planning an attack. In addition to increasing incidents of Islamophobia being reported, this far-right white supremacy is also linked to increases in anti-Semitism, which was spiking well before October 7. And the submission raised examples of groups endorsing attacks against things like power grids, electrical substations and railways. But the biggest concern is lone wolf attacks, and that members use the Christchurch mosque shootings in 2019 as inspiration.
Interestingly, in its submission, ASIO also said that they've found this uptick in Nazi paraphernalia being imported into the country. We saw last year that really quick decision to ban Nazi symbols, so that's flags and, you know, any sort of badges or paraphernalia associated with the Nazi party. So, that's an interesting finding as well.
More than 2,000 Swiss women have successfully sued their government over failure to act on climate change. The group, made mostly of women over the age of 70, had been arguing that they were most at risk of dying in heat waves, and Switzerland had been, to quote, woefully inadequate in addressing climate change. The European Court of Human Rights has ruled the Swiss government had violated some of the women's human rights due to critical gaps in its national legislation to reduce emissions, as well as failure to meet past climate targets.
This is really interesting, and it actually marks the first time the court has ruled on climate litigation. And it is worth noting there is no right of appeal and the judgment is legally binding. So what could this mean in the long run? Well, it does open up other countries to be subject to these matters of litigation in the courts. And it could also force Switzerland to reduce its consumption of fossil fuels and bring down its emissions more rapidly. So, I think it's attention grabbing. 2,000 women over 70 sue their government, but it could actually have really big implications down the track.
Yeah, so at first when I looked at this, I was like, that's symbolic, that's cute, I like it, I'm here for it. But I do wonder how it's going to play out and what accountability there will be for Switzerland to actually reduce its consumption of fossil fuels.
And Hobart's Museum of Old and New Art, known as MONA, has been ordered to allow men into its Ladies' Lounge art installation. So this piece was created in 2020 and it sought to exclude men from the space so it could mirror women's experiences throughout history. The Tasmanian Civil and Administrative Tribunal found MONA was in contravention of the state's Anti-Discrimination Act and ordered MONA to allow, quote, persons who do not identify as ladies to access the installation within the next 28 days. This legal action was launched, unsurprisingly, by a man. He's from New South Wales. His name is Jason Lau, and he claimed being denied entry due to his gender was discrimination.
Oh, man, I have so many thoughts on this. But before I jump into them, I'll talk a little bit more about the Ladies' Lounge. It sees entrants pampered by male butlers and served champagne while being surrounded by some of the museum's finest pieces of art. The artist behind the installation had previously said that she's absolutely delighted that the case had ended up in the court, saying that men are experiencing Ladies' Lounge. Their experience of rejection is the artwork. Their experiencing of having to navigate the judicial system is part of the experience. MONA has previously flagged they could remove the Ladies' Lounge altogether if ordered by a court to let blokes in, saying the refusal of men is the point of the work. The museum says they're deeply disappointed by this decision. And look, Sasha, I was there late last year with my two daughters and my husband, who had no issue waiting outside while we went in. He thought it was really interesting that we could experience something. And the girls came out and they were so excited. Like, Daddy, it's just for girls. I mean, they weren't served champagne, obviously. But I just think in 2024, if your biggest grievance as a bloke that you can't walk into an art installation, life's pretty good, buddy, because a woman a week is still being killed at the hands of a former or current partner. There are so many ways in which our lives are still unequal to that of blokes. And this, to me, reeks of the fact that the laws are problematic, not that the Ladies' Lounge was problematic.
I can just picture, like, the type of person who would take umbrage at this, and it's someone who probably says, oh, well, they're always complaining, so I'll give them something to complain about. Like, it's just, you know, I find it interesting that the museum wants to potentially pull down the exhibit, saying...
I think that's a better move.
Yeah.
I reckon a better move is get rid of it.
Yeah.
Because there are many markers and many times in history when the laws have failed society. Not that the act was problematic. And so I'm like, screw you, Jason. You're not entering the Ladies' Lounge. We're taking it out.
All right, Antoinette, being here for the headlines. Next up, it is our deep dive into the Alice Springs curfew with our producer, Simon Beaton.
Building windows smashed, the door of a local tavern being kicked in, a car set on fire. This is what was happening in Alice Springs just a few weeks ago, until the Northern Territory Chief Minister, Eva Lawler, declared an emergency situation. That saw an additional 60 police officers moving into Alice, plus 20 more from South Australia, in an attempt to target the crime and antisocial behaviour that had become rampant. It also triggered what was initially a two-week curfew for those under the age of 18 from being allowed anywhere in the CBD overnight. And we've just heard that's now been extended almost another week until 6 a.m. next Tuesday, April 16th. While no curfew-related arrests have been made so far, when it first began, about 50 to 60 kids were being moved on each night. And even more recently, there's still about 30 kids that are being moved on. So how have the last few weeks actually felt like for a young person living in Alice Springs? Have these changes made an improvement, or are they a band-aid? Imani Francois is a local 18-year-old who works as a support caseworker in town. Imani, thank you for joining me. Tell me, has the curfew been effective?
The curfew has been effective for the days that it has been on for. It's definitely quietened the town, but then again, it's like what's happening in suburbs. Crime has been just pushed out to suburbs and stuff. So it's been effective for in town, but outside of town, young people have just been going to suburbs and still not going home or to a safe space. Whether that's because their home's not safe or they don't feel safe at their home. The curfew has been effective for the CBD, but not so much for the whole of Alice.
What was it like before the curfew came in?
I think it was pretty much crowded in town. There were people everywhere. People, I mean, youth. There was a lot of young people in town. But at the moment, there's a lot of adults in town. I think there's more adults in the CBD than young people. And I think that just reflects on why aren't these people at their house, or where are they from, or where are they going? Come past like 6 o'clock, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, there's a lot of, adults on the streets in the CBD. I think a lot of the stigma is around young people, but I think there's also a lot of older people in town.
So tell me more about that energy. Like, how are locals in Alice Springs feeling right now?
I think some locals are feeling quite safe and other locals feeling quite disappointed. I think the ones feeling safe are the ones that live in the CBD and around. And I think the ones that are feeling unsafe are the ones that, I don't know, are just outside of town and the young people are pushing out, because most of the town camp surroundings in suburbs of Alice Springs, not so much the CBD. We still have crime happening in Alice Springs. It's not like crime is completely stopped and is on freeze. There was a stolen car about, last night. I was driving and I seen it. So it's still prevalent. It's still happening, but it's a little bit less, I guess. But what is a little bit less and what is a little bit more, and who determines those statistics? So it's really hard to kind of put a finger on it, I guess, and say if it is working or if it isn't working, because I think crime in Alice Springs is also so off and on. Like, it's either really happening or it's really not happening. There's no really sort of in between.
The curfew is for young people. Is this a youth problem in Alice?
I think it is a youth problem, but I think it's also a government problem and a community problem. I think the reason why crime gets put onto young people is because there's nothing for young people to do in Alice Springs. You know, we have all of these places and centres and sport and rec stuff, but it's like that only happens to a certain amount of time. And so when they close, what happens after that? It's really, it's underlying the main issue of what's actually happening, and it's kind of sweeping it under the rug and not really wanting to face it front on and see, you know, how can we help these organisations? What kind of funding, what kind of support, what kind of facilities do we need to ensure that, you know, our young people are feeling safe and content and have things to do instead of, you know, doing wrong?
Mm. Well, I mean, obviously there's no quick fix to something like this.
Yeah.
If there is more public disorder and violence in Alice in the future, how would you like the government to respond?
I think the government just needed to realise that as Aboriginal people, and especially as young people, we're feeling the impacts of, you know, intergenerational trauma, of, you know, feeling disadvantaged than the majority. It was really disappointing that the government just thinks that police are going to just mend crime and police are going to be that support, because police aren't going to be that support. You know, police, we're really terrified of the police as Aboriginal people, especially as youth, you know. it only sparks more fear with the inquest that happened with Kumanj Walker. So we think about all those things and how, you know, we don't want to end up as a statistic. We don't want to end up as just another number, you know, passing away from police brutality or passing away from things that could have been prevented, you know, things that could have been supported. I think a lot of the time government love reinventing the wheel and love reinventing services and facilities for young people, but it's about staying with those frameworks and bettering them and wanting to put money in them and wanting to pour, you know, support and exposure into them. I think it's, you know, it's always money being pulled, you know, it's always money being pulled, no money getting put in and, you know, continuing that kind of support, yeah, from government, yeah.
Well, I mean, this does come after the Voice referendum failed last year. In your mind, mm-hmm. are the two in any way connected?
I think we would have passed if we would have gotten that Voice to Parliament. This issue that's happening now would have been prevented. I think we would have had more kind of insight and understanding from all levels, from a white man's perspective and an Aboriginal perspective. We would have been able to bridge that gap and kind of have a common ground in, you know, what goals we wanted to see for Alice Springs and how we wanted this crime to just kind of disappear and how we can better support it. So I think without the Voice now, we have to stop thinking about it, I guess, and stop dwelling on what we could have had and start thinking, you know, what we need to have and what we like really need to have right now. Yeah, because I was a big part of Hands on the Conference, Youth Conference. So I looked at all the research that they had put in to do for domestic violence, alcohol and drug related crime just in general. And that all stemmed back to mental health. And we've seen that there was a common denominator, and it was the mental health and the well-being of these people, whether they were old or whether they were young. So it just shows that mental health and support in that sector is so absent, and we need more of it, support. And it's hard to say what we need when we don't have it as well. So I think in terms of support, we need an Indigenous kind of framework to help mental health in that sector, because I think Indigenous mental health compared to someone that's non-Indigenous, it's very different. It's very different and it's more complex. So that was one of the main denominators when I was a dialect in one of those conferences as a youth person. Yeah.
We've heard that the curfew is going to be extended. Do you think that this is a good thing and it will give the community a bit more of a breather, a bit more of a break, or is it only going to make the problems worse in the long term?
It being extended, I think it's good for Alice Springs, for the people that aren't, you know, youth. But I think as youth, it's not good. You really have to look at these from two different scopes and you have to see from two different perspectives, you know, what's good for this person, what's good for this person. I think it's good for the people that have businesses and they're having a break with their businesses being broken into, people that are having a break with their cars and their houses being broken into inside the CBD. But I think when you look at it from a young person's perspective, it's hiding once again. It's running from the law, I guess, you know. It's running and constantly living a fast life of thinking, when is my next meal? When is the next time I'm going to be able to sleep in a comfortable bed, you know?
Yes.
Like, my house isn't a comfortable space nor a safe space. It's another 2 weeks of having to run and feel displaced, you know, in a society that doesn't want to accept or try and understand me, yeah.
So what do we do then to support those younger people who perhaps don't have a safe mm-hmm. bed or a regular bed to go back to, or don't have anywhere to go when the curfew is in place?
Yeah, well, I think bringing police in, and especially the 200 police that cost $200 million, I think that sounds like a scare tactic to me. That sounds like we're going to bring more people in because it's working. And like, I think a lot of young people are feeling scared. And so what we could have done to prevent this quite easily was, I don't know, trying to find a space where there's a drop-in center for young people to come in and know that there's a guaranteed feed there for free, guaranteed water, a place to shower, a station that's not just for people that are going to rehab, but people that don't have anywhere to go. We have Saltbush, we have Bushmob, we have the women's shelter, but we don't have any specified place for any Indigenous person, no matter if you're privileged, no matter if you're not, to go and have a feed, have a shower, have a rest. I think it's important that we have one of those drop-in centres, yeah, in Alice Springs especially, yeah. But not just Alice Springs, I think everywhere. I think everywhere we really need a space for young people to be able to know that, you know, there's a place for them to come and there are people there willing to give, you know, emotional support, even if you don't specialise in that field, just someone there, yeah.
I think that's a very good idea, Imani. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
That was one of our producers, Simon Beaton, speaking with Imani Francois, a young support case youth worker from Alice Springs. And that is it for this morning's briefing. Bension will be back from 3 with another deep dive. And make sure you never miss any of our episodes. To do that, click subscribe or follow now on whichever app you're using. And if you did enjoy today's ep, why not pass it along to a friend or two? We definitely will love you for it. I'm Sasha Barbagat. Thank you for joining me.
Listener.